carried on about the bad hat.
Let's see how this is coming out. So you had a lot of bad hats from where?
Well, they were from the two of our own destroyers who are already in UK waters, the Iroquois and the Restitution, and they both had a quasi-mutiny or serious personnel troubles. And here they were with others directly from Canada, all in this ship's company, this new ship. And I spoke to them when we commissioned with some misgivings, because amongst other things I had to tell them that we were going to do our workups in Scapa Flow, which had been the scene of their troubles, or some of them. But I have to say that somehow they got together and settled down and formed an excellent ship's company, and I never had any better shipmates ever.
Tell me what kind of things you said to a bunch, knowing you had had some mutineers there.
I spoke to them about the ship's rearmament, and that we had the latest equipment available, and that the news from the Battle of the Atlantic was good, and all we had to do was get out there and make it better, and they seemed to appreciate this, and off we went.
But Jimmy Hibbert took over Iroquois about that time, I think.
That's right.
And he told me that all his predecessors' orders would stay in force. He wasn't going to run the ship any differently from the way his predecessors had done, and they just... he gave a sort of... It's the trouble with Jimmy. He gets incoherent when he tries to tell you what he said, but he said they turned out to be very good under him.
Yes, well, I had the same experience. They seemed to give me a very young and inexperienced captain. I was only 26 years old, and and I think it's true of the Canadian sailor generally. He'll trust you and stand by you unless you give him reasons to do otherwise.
What was this trouble in the rescue, which I don't think that's come up before?
Well, it was... David Bruce was the captain, and Ralph Hennessy was the first lieutenant, and for reasons which I forget or perhaps never knew, the men locked themselves in the mess deck and refused to turn to, but eventually they got it all sorted out.
So they split some of them up. It's the usual thing to do, isn't
That's
it?
Right.
Yeah. So you got them, and they turned out to be fine. So there you are in your first trip, 26-year-old Patrick Nixon, acting lieutenant commander.
Yeah, it's a great experience, and a very humbling one, because of the trust that the men placed in you. And I found, actually, that's my nicest memory of World War II was just that, how the loyalty of the men and the way they really worked hard to come through well. And sometimes in the middle of the night we'd be rushing through the ocean, and I'd be going up and down the ladders as the men were changing watches, and they'd naturally say to me, "Hello, Captain," or "Hello, sir," and in the next breath I always wanted to know, "What's happening?" Well, more often than not, the orders were confused, and you only hoped you were doing the right thing and didn't quite know what was happening yourself. But I tried at least to put on a pose of serene confidence and say, "Oh, well, don't worry, we're just joining another formation or some such thing."
Yes. One of the hardest jobs about being captain is not showing your own worry, isn't it?
Yes.
So your first operational trip was where?
Our first operation was in the Eastern Atlantic, and we were...
Excuse me, I just want to...
We were a support group. In other words, we didn't form the close escort of any convoy. We just stayed in the most probable U-boat zone and went to the aid of any convoy that appeared to be threatened.
So you're the first of the hunter-killer groups.
That's right. And we, on this operation, we were at sea for about a month, but we went into the Azores twice to refuel, and otherwise we refueled at sea. And we had some excitements. The first thing that happened was we, on the daily disposition of signal of our own forces of where they were placed, they said that there was an American major warship of some kind escorted by destroyers. I think it was an escort aircraft carrier escorted by destroyers in our general vicinity, and it appeared that we would pass on opposite courses. And we were ahead of the convoy escort on an advanced screen, and my ship was the Chaudière, was the starboard wing ship. And who should come along but this American group on an opposite course. They got us on their radar. I guess they didn't get the same disposition signal of friendly forces, and they thought we were a U-boat and opened fire on us. Well, we tried to make every form of identification, and also I had to go at full speed ahead through fairly heavy seas to avoid their shell fire. And we thought we'd got it all sorted out, and suddenly they came in and opened fire again. And by this time I was worried. It seemed almost totally unlikely that any enemy surface ships were in the vicinity, but I was beginning to doubt it. I felt almost certain that the true state of affairs. But here they are, opened fire on us again. And so I gave the order to load our guns, because you couldn't just be fired at and not fire back. But fortunately, I never gave the order to open fire back at them. I perhaps wouldn't be here today. And after this second excitement with these shells and tracers going right across the ship, it was a miracle that we weren't hit by some of their lighter projectiles anyway. Eventually, they finally realized who we were, and they sent us a signal, "Are you hurt?" I think they probably felt sure they'd hit us, and we replied that no, but our feelings were, and the ships passed in the night. I heard long afterwards that an official apology was sent by the Canadian government, the American government, to the Canadian government for firing on a Canadian ship, but more importantly, at least to our greater relief, the ship that had fired at us was eventually sunk herself by the Germans, so we felt there was one less menace about in the North Atlantic.
What was the closest range at which she was firing?
I can't remember. I should think about probably 5,000 or 6,000 yards.
It would have to be, because she was firing her small stuff.
Yes, it would be about 5,000 yards.
It's very strong-willed of you not to open fire.
And we were zigzagging at high speed with green seas coming over the bridge because we were trying to shake this off the pursuit of this fellow.
What were our other ships doing? They must have had you in sight.
Yes, well, they could see or hear the shell fire at night, but we were quite broadly disposed.
We're into radar now. They had radar. Yes. They must have had them on their screen.
Yes, and they did. Well, I gave a full account of it to our senior officer the next morning, and he asked me about it, of course, and he duly reported it, and they were learned.
Who was your senior officer?
And he was an RM officer, Commander P.W. Burnett. And
B-U-R-N-E-T-T,
yeah. Which I think he pronounced Burnett, but we called him Burnett.
Yeah. And he was in what?
And he was in the St. Catharines, frigate St. Catharines. Not in command, but as a riding senior officer.
A Canadian frigate.
And that was typical of the time, because we had such a shortage of officers of that rank in the RCN that they had several RM commanders in command of Canadian escort groups.
Not RCN temps, serving RM commanders?
Serving RM officers, yes. Oh. We had MacKillop was one. I can't think of the name. No. I remember another one. I can't think of his name.
Yeah. What other Canadian ships then?
And we had...
Wasn't St. Catharines
a frigate?
A frigate, yeah.
Yes. And we had, in that group, we had the Canadian destroyer Gatineau and the British destroyer Icarus and the Chaudière, three destroyers, and we also had about three corvettes. I remember the Chilliwack and the Fennel. We probably had another one.
A real mixed bag.
Yes.
In fact, you know, that's not a good attack group, is it?
No, it was
corvettes, frigates.
It was a strange outfit for the duties assigned to being a support group. However, on that same operation, we got a sonar contact, and after 30 hours of hunting and many attacks, eventually the U-boat, the U-744, came to the surface and surrendered. And we tried to take her in tow, but the seas were too high.
They didn't scuttle?
No, they didn't. We had a boarding party sent aboard from my ship, which stopped them from scuttling.
No, gosh, tell me more about that. That's very exciting, because...
Yeah. And...
You must have had a good drill worked out. They prevented for scuttling.
Well, they prevented. Charles Rathgeb was in charge of our boarding party, now the president of Canadian Comstock International, and he had no nonsense about him. There were two other ships sent whalers under oars, and one of them capsized, and the other was in pretty poor shape. And we, based on our experience in Scapa Flow, previous winter, we lowered our motorboat, which was unorthodox, but was much more efficient and made the whalers look ridiculous.
Yes, of course.
And in addition to saving the survivors of the German U-boat, we also saved some of our own people from their whalers.
Did you come in close before lowering your motor cutter? How far?
Oh, half a mile or
half
less.
A mile.
Quarter of half a
and
mile.
You dropped Rathgeb. Now, who did you have on board? He had a signalman. He had some ERAs. Who?
Yes, well, I can't remember the. We had our boarding party and the boat's crew, and they did a good job. Rathgeb was there with his 45 revolver out, and the Germans, they were exhausted. It was the second longest hunt in the whole war, 30 hours, and they really came up for air. They were damaged, but basically exhausted, and so they didn't have much spirit left to them.
But their orders were to scuttle.
Yes, but
they didn't.
They didn't.
Did
and the captain was killed.
Yeah.
But we got the...
He was killed by your small arms fire.
Yeah, well, yes, everybody was firing at it. It was a very very one-sided action when the U-boat came to the surface, virtually surrounded by our ships, and everybody firing at once and then sending boarding parties. So I guess they were a pretty intimidating experience under their exhausted condition.
And your ERAs, I guess, knew how to prevent her scuttling because an AFO, a CAFO had come out on her.
Yes, well, I don't, as I recall, they made no attempt to scuttle the ship. They were demoralized. And this was in March, early March, 44.
Because that U-boat captain would have got into a lot of trouble had he got back before the end of the war for not scuttling.
Yeah, so it was an interesting experience to have. We had about 14 or 20 prisoners on board on the way back to Derry for two or three days, I didn't see them because I was on the bridge all the time. But my own officers told me that one of them spoke German, and that the two things that surprised the Germans, one was we seemed to be light-hearted, everybody laughing all the time, which didn't seem to appeal to their Teutonic seriousness about life. And the other thing was the food. They couldn't get over the good food, and which was aided and abetted by the fact that been to the Azores and loaded up with fresh fruit and pineapples and oranges and stuff that they'd never seen in Germany for years. And of course, my boys didn't let on about this. They just said, oh, well, the ordinary rough rations is in.
Tell me, did they still think they were going to win the war at that stage?
They seem to be, they seem to be reasonably confident. And when we got into Derry, the senior survivor of this group asked to see me, and I did, and with our interpreter, he thanked me for the good treatment they'd, they'd received, and so I naturally said the obvious thing that, if our situations had been reversed, I'm sure you would have treated us as well. And he said, oh, well, those circumstances would never have arisen because in the U-boat service we don't take prisoners. So they were still pretty cocky even at that stage of the war.
Is that where you got your DSC?
No, I got mentioned in dispatches.
Where I missed that. Where did you get your DSC then?
Oh, it was. I got it for. We actually sank three U-boats, or shared them, sinking the three
U-boats.
This is
the same ship.
Yeah, the same ship.
Well, we'll come to it then.
Yeah, I got two mentions in dispatches, and then the third U-boat, they didn't actually, wasn't officially credited until after the war was over, and nobody got any decorations for that, but I guess they took pity on me, and I eventually got the DSC for the conduct of the ship during the whole operations in the Bay of Biscay and the Channel in 1944.
Well, that's good. Two MIDs and a DSC, that's good. We were talking about how if we had been in another navy, you would have had two Bronze Stars.
That's right.
Instead of two little oak leaf clusters, which nobody notices.
Yes, I always thought that a mention of dispatches was a rather insignificant or certainly indistinct award for doing anything, as so many officers and men after long and successful service, probably over several years in the Battle of the Atlantic, their only award was a mention of the dispatches, which you have to look pretty hard at somebody to even detect at all. Whereas, as I understand it, the equivalent in the U.S. Armed Forces is a Bronze Star, a proper medal with a ribbon, which seems a more appropriate recognition.
Yes, it is. If you're not going to pay people well or feed them well and keep them at sea all the time, you could at least give them medals.
That's right.
Well, on to your next action.
Well, we did some transatlantic convoys, and again as a support group, as a backup escort, and those were uneventful as far as action was concerned. And then we got back to our base, Londonderry, or Derry as it was always called, and we were already thinking about the invasion of Europe, or the, as the French say, the débarquement, the landings in Normandy, and we were reformed into Escort Group 11 of five Canadian destroyers, and we had a very fine senior officer escort, I suppose really the best known or most successful Canadian U-boat hunter of the war, the late Douglas Prentice. He was a commander, and he was in command first of first of the Ottawa, and later of the Capel, when we were reformed a second time. But to start with, we had the Ottawa, Gatineau, Saloon, Kootenay, and Chaudière.
Who were your brother captains, and besides Chummy Prentice?
Well, in the Gatineau, we had Harold Goose. In the Saloon, we had Gus Bolton.
Yes.
And in the Kootenay, we had Bill Wilson.
Double L Wilson?
Yes, a very able fellow indeed. That group as a whole took part in the destruction of three U-boats in the English Channel and the Bay of Biscay combined, and my ship actually was present in two of them.
So there's this first U-boat you sunk,
yes,
and now three more.
Yeah, yeah. There were three ships, the Ottawa, Kootenay, Chaudière, three destroyers, and there was one frigate.
No, we won't turn it off. It'll come. We just let the tape run on. It'll occur to you later.
And the one frigate whose name I'll think of in a moment were the only ships in the RCM that took part in the confirmed destruction of three German U-boats. They were the only ships.
And Prentice
Swansea was
Swansea,
the frigate.
Yeah.
The frigate under your old captain...
King.
C.A. King, yes. So I think that was a very good record for Escort Group 11.
Well, tell me about Chummy running his five ships when you have a contact. How did he? What did he do with the five of you?
Well, he always used to say, "I like to put myself in the shoes of the U-boat commander," and he looked at it that way and tried to imagine what the other fellow was doing. And he was had a great knack for anti-submarine operations, and he was a fine fellow, a gentleman of the old school, and he had already sunk a U-boat when he was in command of a corvette, and he sank, was mixed up in the sinking of three more in Escort Group 11, so he had an outstanding record.
But you can only have one ship holding and one ship attacking. What did you do with the other three?
Yeah. Oh, well, you'd usually have, the other ship would usually do a circular patrol in case the U-boat had escaped, the third ship, and get contact that way, and then come in and relieve one of the other two. And Prentice, he was a good decentralizer. He didn't try to do everything himself, and he made use of the initiative of his own of his other captains and his own officers and his own ship, and he was very very well liked and a good fellow all round. And when we got ashore. We used to celebrate so much that we thought it would be a relief to go to sea again. And then when we were at sea, we said, for God's sake, let's get ashore and relax. But there'd be so many parties, we'd want to go to sea again. And I admired Chummy Prentice, because here he was nearly 20 years a senior of his other captains, and he tried to keep pace with our social antics at the same time. And the doctor, the medical officer of my ship, Alistair MacDonald, he used to treat Chummy for what he called jippy tummy, which is a result of too much partying and too much loss of sleep and so forth, and he gave him a potion which had a bit of morphine in it that sort of paralyzed his stomach for a while, and then he gave him a rest, and then he was all right to keep going again.
A good MD.
But I personally liked Chummy Prentice as a man, and of course admired his prowess at sea.
I met Mrs. Prentice out here at the funeral of Captain Grant.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, she's still as energetic as he was.
I'll tell you another anecdote about Chummy Prentice. One time, his ship got damaged or had something the matter with it, and we were to go on an operation, so he came to my ship, bringing his own steward along, and he was given the use of the chart house as his sea cabin, and we were separated by 3/16 of an inch of steel plating, and his steward brought him his meals and my steward brought me my meals. Well, on about the second or third day out, I had an idea. Why not invite Chummy to come round the other side of the thin plating and sit side by side on my bunk while the two stewards brought us our meals? And the operation turned out to be so successful that we continued it for the rest of the operation.
Of course, it's very good. And Beck was with a senior officer. Yeah, yeah, he was of that breed, very good. It's hard to use such a weak expression as very good. I was just looking at something appropriate to say about him, but it would sound too flowery.
Well, he was a Canadian, from a ranch in the interior of BC, but who had had but had served as some Canadians did in the Royal Navy, and his career was somewhat of a parallel of a famous Captain F.J. Walker in the RN, who had a rather indifferent success in peacetime, but the Battle of the Atlantic and fighting U-boats successfully gave them both their big opportunity, which they fully exploited.
We in Oakville felt the same way about Clarence King as you did about Chummy Prentice, because Clarence King was immeasurably older than we were. We were all in our early 20s,
yes.
And he seemed ancient to us.
Yeah.
because he was NR, and he had come from fruit farming in the Okanagan,
yes.
And it was hard on him, a Corvette. We didn't know any other way to live. We thought it was normal.
Yes.
Well, you've sunk two U-boats. Do you want to sink the other two?
Yeah. Well,
how long was the longest hunt, that first one, 30 hours?
30 hours, yeah. And I believe there was one other hunt. I don't know where or when, but it was a little bit longer, but as I recall, it was the second longest.
Yeah. Did they surface?
They surfaced, slightly damaged, but basically for lack of air, they were exhausted.
Yeah. And scuttled?
And they scuttled. As I mentioned, they suffered quite a bit of damage from shell fire after they surfaced, and had several of the crew, including the captain, killed. And as I remember, I don't think they even attempted to scuttle. They were pretty well demoralized. Naturally, since this U-boat was right there on the surface, we wanted to take her in tow and bring her back and capture her in triumph, but it was too rough to do that. The weather deteriorated rapidly, as it infamously does on the North Atlantic, and so one of the ships just put a torpedo into her and sank her that way.
Well, you've got three to account for. What happened to the other two? Did they surface?
No. The other two, one was sunk in the Bay of Biscay.
Never came up.
No survivors at all, but plenty of evidence. We had documents, with Berlin and the date written on, and various bits of pieces and flotsam and jetsam. And it was initially, that was the U-61. It was at the outset given a probable destruction, but shortly afterwards confirmed destruction. And the third one was the U-985. Which we got contact with only two or three days after the one in the Bay of Biscay, and she was right off Brest, quite close into Brest, and we were experienced with what was a U-boat and what was not, and we were sure that it was a U-boat, and we duly attacked it, and we were all running out of fuel and had to get back to our base at Plymouth. Or perhaps if he'd hung around longer, we might have got some more convincing wreckage, which we did not get. And we claimed it, of course, but it wasn't until after the war that they confirmed that we had sunk this U-985, which was a disappointment to me, because I'd had quite a few of my officers and men recommended for decorations and mentioned dispatches, and which some of them received, but I tried to put in some more, but they wouldn't do it. They wouldn't. The policy appeared to be that they wouldn't take away decorations for people who were credited with sinking a U-boat, but in fact did not, and they wouldn't give anything to people who did in fact sink U-boats, but it wasn't found out until after the war was over.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Yeah.
Oh, that's too bad, because there are so many...
And there were no survivors from that U-boat.
No.
So that is a really bleak example of the harshness of war. There were, in the space of two or three days, we sank two U-boats, and there were no survivors from either one.
Of the 1,200... I forgot it, the 50,000 men that served in U-boats, only 12,000 lived?
Yeah.
Something like that.
But
if you
lose a war, you tend to have a greater number of casualties, and therefore you have very fine war memorials. And many years later, in 1963, I was with my destroyer squadron in Kiel in Schleswig-Holstein, big famous German naval base, and they asked me to lay a wreath on the German National Naval War Memorial, which commemorates both world wars and is very fine. But I was also asked to lay a wreath on their very beautiful U-boat memorial. And as you say, they had about 75% casualties out of this force. And anyway, to say the obvious thing, I thought I was a suitable choice to lay the wreath on the U-boat memorial, because I'd spent most of the war chasing U-boats.
A couple of the book reviews I've had of this last book that I put out decry the bit wherein I say that we in the Canadian Navy, apart from disliking the Germans for shooting at us, really admired them as fighting men and as sailors.
Oh, yes. You certainly, you can say their cause was extremely unworthy, but that was not in any way to detract from their professional, operational service, because I think anybody who was in the Battle of the Atlantic has to think of these men attacking half-submerged on the surface, strapped onto the conning tower so they wouldn't be washed overboard, and coming in the latter part of the war against very daunting odds and pressing home their attacks. So they were very brave people and very able as well.
Yeah. Well, that's quite something. You're a real U-boat killer. I didn't really realize this all the years I worked for you.
Yes, fortunately, I guess, and we were in action with other U-boats, which we did not sink, of course, as everybody else was, and I think at least two known U-boats in the Bay of Biscay, which got away.
But you were in on four sinkings?
Three sinkings.
Three.
Well, I was in on four, if you count the one in 1940.
Yeah, I count that. Four. There are not very many people have been on four U-boat sinkings, confirmed.
Yeah.
I know people that have been on in 10 unconfirmed.